afternoon, ladies and germs. Welcome to another edition of Movie Moan, your TMT podcast. I'm Jamie, here with you as always. And with me is my good buddy, the British gentleman agent, Mr. Phil G. Say hello, sir.
Hello.
Well said. Also joining us...
Sorry, I just thought I'd try something different for a change.
I feel a lot of anger.
Yeah, I know.
Anger leads to fear.
Fear leads to hate. Hate leads to...
Leads to the Expendables.
Spoiler.
Spoiler. I fucking detested it. We'll get to that later. Sitting to my left is the star of Ed Hocken's show on braindeadradio.com, Captain Ed Hocken.
Yes, thank you, Phil, and I'm proud to announce we've just recorded a new episode. It should be up this week. So, yes, I know it's been a little bit of a drought, but we are back with a whole new episode, soon to be put up sometime this week. So definitely check it out over at braindeadradio.com. And also joining us is the man, as always, from the Great White North, Lou.
Thanks, everybody. That's good news, Ed. And I want to say hello to everybody, and a special hello to MNS, the Shamhammer, Shyamalan. I want a little message I have for you about possibly saving your career.
You want to just go and do it now? Go ahead. It's on your mic. By all means, the floor is yours. Go ahead.
Well, at the screening of Scott Pilgrim versus the World, one of the trailers that ran in front of the movie started off with a situation where a bunch of people got into an elevator, and of course the elevator broke down and they couldn't get out, and then weird things proceeded to happen, and I sat there watching it, and the entire audience was totally into it, and then all of a sudden it cut to black, and then it says, Devil, a film by M. Night Shyamalan, and the whole theater just broke out in derisive catcalls and laughing. So, Mr. Shyamalan, I'm telling you right now, you've got some major PR work on your hands to do. When I thought was a decent trailer, did you guys see the same trailer?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And did you think it was pretty decent, or
I didn't care for it?
I agree with Jamie. I didn't care about this one bit. So
I was intrigued by it because I'd never seen it before. So I'm like, oh, what's this? You know. And then I'd heard about it. The Devil, it's called. He's producing. He's not directing it. But, so basically they're remaking The Lift. Is that what it is?
I don't know. I've never heard of that movie.
Fair enough.
But, in my theater, everybody seemed to be into it. I was quite enjoying it. But as soon as his name came up, you could just feel the air going out of any chance of that movie making any money. And I think that, Mr. Shyamalan, it is time for you to get an alias and start making movies under a different name, because nobody's going to come and see anything that you do anymore.
Max Power.
Yeah. Call yourself Ed Wood Jr. or something. I don't know.
Didn't Shyamalan write this movie, though? He wrote this movie, didn't he? Because that explains why there's an Indian guy.
Yes, it's based on an idea. Short story.
See, he probably feels he has toned things down, Luke, because at least now he's not addressing things in the trailers as a bedtime story by M. Night Shyamalan or things like that. Yeah. He's just calling it a film, you know. It's not...
Well, I mean, we're running out of excuses with this guy. It's like, you know, look, what was that movie that came out, the one that came out two summers ago with Marky Mark?
The
Happening. It's like, see, M. Night Shyamalan's first R-rated movie. Who cares? See, M. Night Shyamalan, adapt someone else's material. See, M. Night, I don't want to see M. Night Shyamalan do anything.
And it's only R-rated because of the amount of cussing you'll hear from audiences in the theater while you're watching it. That's the only reason it's R-rated. Yeah.
It's time for him to... go below the surface and work more behind the scenes if he wants to continue working in the business.
Is that code for sucking people off? I'm sorry, I'm a little...
You are angry today, aren't you?
Below the surface?
Damn you, Stallone.
What does that mean in L.A.?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Low profile.
Anyway, thing about Shyamalan, like, I mean, when did he lose it? I thought he lost it with The Village, a movie that I liked his first three movies. Well, I say first three movies. He actually directed two of the movies before The Sixth Sense. One was called, I think, Wide Awake, I think, with the Rosie O'Donnell. I'm going off memory on that one, about a kid in Catholic school or an orphanage or something. But, like, in terms of, like, when he became M. Night Shyamalan, the brand name, he did three really good movies. I mean, Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, and Signs. And for me, he lost it with Village. I don't know where you guys stand on when he lost his touch, or if he even had it.
Well, I think
he had
that.
Okay. Fair enough.
The classic story, of course, goes that he brought Lady in the Water to Disney, wasn't
yes.
it? And they turned it down.
Well, they didn't turn it down. They gave him notes. They're like, well,
that's correct. Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
It's a potential.
And so he decided not only then and there would he fuck them, make the movie somewhere else, but also write a book about how awesome he was for fucking them and going on and doing it by himself. And I think that's the definitive moment, probably right there. Did that book even come out?
I don't think he wrote that book. I think someone else wrote that about him, if I remember correctly.
Well, yeah. Well, no, there you go. That's the pseudonym thing that Lou's talking about there.
Ah, I see. I see what yeah. you just did there.
Maybe, yeah. maybe, maybe. But, yeah, I agree. Like, I think after The Village, people were just waiting to drop the hammer on him without whatever his next project was. And when he came up with his next project after, like you said, with a bad PR with Disney and that, and basically wrote, produced, directed, and even starred in this movie in one of the major roles, people just unloaded on
yeah,
him.
Yeah, and he kills and, critics, too. That's even worse.
He kills critics. So I'm probably, and I'm a crowd of one, but I actually really like Lady in Water more than The Village, but a lot of people didn't like that movie because it was too on the nose, and that was game over for him at that point. So,
one of the things I find fascinating, though, and you correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe this is a silly question, but he is, at the moment, he's in the same kind of field of, from the perspective of the public and of critics, he's in that same field of legendary badness as Dr. Uwe Boll. But for some reason, people just let Uwe Boll films just slide.
I don't think people.
But Uwe Boll never made anything good.
Yeah, I don't. Well, I don't think people
ever fell.
I don't think people know who Uwe Boll is. Actually, to be frankly, like people know who M. Night Shyamalan is. They know that name. Very few directors you say the name people know you're talking about, and M. Night's one of them. I mean Spielberg, Cameron.
Sense put him on the public conscious, and his, people knew who he was.
And
Uwe
he was,
Boll was a B-list director. He never made anything that caught the public's attention.
I mean, Toni Collette got nominated for The Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
So what does that tell you? God damn, I forgot that kid's name. Already,
Haley Joel Osment.
Right, he put him on the map from that movie.
Yeah.
So.
It was a huge thing in 99. Yeah. Well, I remember when that movie came out, like they were promoting it, and nobody gave away the ending at all. In the promotions leading up to that weekend, the only thing I remember was like a press interview like on E-Television back when, well, I was going to say back when that was good, but I'm being silly. It was Bruce Willis talking about how really good the kid was, and that was it, like, performance-wise. Yeah. You would not know there was a twist ending by the way this movie was being promoted, by the way they were talking about it leading up to the release. But that was the problem, is then it's almost the worst thing he could have done is do Unbreakable a year later because another movie with a twist at the end.
Yeah. He should have done something straightforward, more straightforward.
And then do that, you know.
Exactly.
But instead, he decided, like, no, I'm in this category. And he got lumped in. The same thing that happened with Tim Burton when he made Batman is all of a sudden people said, okay, you are being ordained as the new Spielberg, which there is no new Spielberg. There is just Spielberg. I mean, like, there's going to be other people who are going to make a mark with their big movies. Right now, it's Nolan. But Nolan is by no means the new Spielberg. He's Nolan.
Yep.
It's just lazy labeling.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I do think
but he embraced it. That's the problem. Knight embraced it. And then the Hitchcock thing. So he decided...
And an irony of that, I think, you know, if a filmmaker comes along in the next couple of decades who shows wonderful potential and then completely fucks himself over with all his subsequent movies, he will probably be labeled the next Shamhammer. Or Shyamalan.
Well, no, maybe Shyamalan's turning into Orson Welles. So maybe he'll start promoting, you know, like Mrs. Fields' Peas on television. Get really fat.
Gary did American Express.
That's right, he did. There you go. I'm looking forward to that on the 2020 edition of The Critic when we see Maurice LaMarche do M. Night Shyamalan. Make it happen, movie gods.
So, bottom line, MMS, change your name to Ed Burns or something.
Ooh.
It's not even any better, actually.
That's a striking Ed Burns. What did Ed Burns do to you, dude? He was in a couple of good movies.
Cordwain or Bird. That's Harlan Ellison's pseudonym for scripts that he hated.
If he does that, Harlan Ellison's going to sue him.
Well.
And he will. Yeah, that's the funny thing. He really will sue him. And he'll proclaim about it on his blog that looks like it came from 1990. I say that I love Harlan Ellison. I'm actually a big fan. So Harlan Ellison, the personality, I love. Just the way he used to rant on television all the time about the stupidest little things. I got these baseball cards, and they were stupid, and he talked about them for 5 minutes. That was the greatest thing to watch as a kid. And maybe that's just me. But anyway, MovieCon. Apparently, Phil saw a movie that he really, really hated. And it happened to be the movie that made a whole bunch of money this weekend. Now, Phil, what movie was that, sir?
It was The Expendables, sir. I don't even... Now, just to clarify, it hasn't officially come out in this country. It was a preview, which I caught this weekend. For one thing, because I needed to get out of the house and stop playing video games. And also, my other choice was The Last Airbender. And obviously, what choice are you going to make in that situation? I don't even know... Really, though, why I went to see this film, because we weren't excited about it going in. Every review I've read has given it poor notices. I guess I went out of some stupid sense of obligation to the action films of my youth. And this film was supposed to be the wet dream we've all been waiting for at least 2 decades. You know, they get together, the ultimate cast of action heroes from the 80s and from the 90s as well, and they battle evil for 90 minutes. What could be hard about that? But that's part of the problem with the film, I suppose. I think practically everyone who wanted to see this film had a better version of it in their heads, building up for the last 2 decades and going in rather than what we got on the screen. So I'm self-conscious of that. I was going in, and I could forgive the movie a lot given those impossible expectations it would have to live into. But in the words of Frank Langella's Skeletor, I am not in a giving vein this day. The Expendables, no matter what it is trying to be, is an absolute mess. And a god-awful piece of cinema. And now I've heard people say that the action, especially during the end, makes up for its flaws.
No.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. When I watched this film, all I saw was something that's been made before and made better. Specifically,
well,
I was thinking...
Let me chime in, Phil, for a second. What you say, because when I heard about the plot of when I heard about the Expendables, it's like, this sounds like Dogs of War. You ever see Dogs of War? Because I think this probably would have been the better movie to see.
I haven't seen Dogs of War, I'm afraid. No.
Okay. I recommend you check it out.
I will do, sir.
It's a man on a mission movie. I mean, I remember it was the thing about it was Bastards was coming out, and there was a point when it looked like they were going to come out in the same month. They wound up not happening, but there was that kind of situation. I think the thing about this is about this film, and I saw it this weekend also, it's basically a direct-to-video movie that got slapped it with a theatrical release because of Stallone, because of Statham, because of mostly because of the Schwarzenegger and Willis cameos. I think it's trash, but you're either gonna think it's good trash or just plain trash. And I was entertained, but yeah, I can't really argue against anything as Phil's saying, because there's a lot of lazy filmmaking going on here. It's like I said, it's direct to video. You could have put this thing on the $5 bin at Walmart, and you wouldn't have noticed. Without a theatrical release. You could have.
I'm not denying, sir, that there is money on the screen. I'm not saying it's
I don't think there's money on the screen. I disagree with you. I don't really think there's much money on the screen.
Well, not much,
the cheap CGI. Like, just how the awfulness of that.
I guess I wasn't even paying attention by that point.
You were fuming.
Dozing off, probably. Specifically in that last action sequence, what I was thinking of were two films, Stallone's own Rambo, or Rambo 4, and Bad Boys 2. Now, Bad Boys 2 has the exact same 30-minute action climax, the exact same context. It's set in a foreign land. Bunch of guys go to rescue a girl and depose a dictator-slash-drug lord at this big fancy mansion, and all hell breaks loose, and everything's just supposed to go insane, and we're all supposed to go, whoa, that's so insane. But Bad Boys 2, I can't believe I'm saying this, but it's true, did it so much better, and in so much of a more over-the-top and crazy way, and the way things sort of escalate, and in a way that The Expendables just can't. And that film was made 7 to 8 years ago. And as far as Rambo 4 is concerned, I don't know why Stallone thought he could make the craziest, bloodiest, most violent action movie ever when he already did with Rambo. And he did it well. And in fact, that's the only thing that's interesting about that film. The rest of it's a waste, but you can't deny the end of Rambo is absolutely crazy, and he did it really well. And so I don't even know why he's bothering to try it after he made that statement. I guess he thought that if he got together the cast, the Dreamcast, it would be enough to hold our attention and propel the film through. He doesn't have the cast. I understand that he had problems getting Van Damme to do it. And by the way, Jean-Claude Van Damme fucking like one smart motherfucker from where I'm sitting tonight. But if he couldn't get Willis and Arnold and Seagal and Norris and Jackie Chan to stay through the whole film, then there was no point making the film. I'm sorry, you don't care about any of the guys that they do get. They don't have personalities at all.
No.
Jason Statham is terrible in this film, and he has no chemistry with Stallone. No one has chemistry with Stallone. The only person who does have a bit of banter with is Arnold. Arnold arrived on the screen, and him and Stallone actually have an exchange. They play off each other.
That brought down the house, I will add.
Yes! It's not like it's just hype, dude. It's not like, oh, we're so happy to see them on frame together. Because it's actually, they did try. There's some good, well, it's not good dialogue, but at least they're interacting with each other.
No, but that closing line was pretty damn funny, I will say.
It was pretty good. It's got this chemistry there. The film actually comes alive for a bit, but Arnold's only on screen for less than 60 seconds, and he walks off again, and I'm like, no, please, come back.
Come back.
Don't need you.
And then you have Bruce Willis basically playing Bruce Willis.
Oh, he was terrible, actually.
Well, I will say, though, I think I know why he agreed to put his mug on the one sheet, because he figured, you know what, this won't be the worst movie that my name has been involved with in 2010. Go ahead. I think that's why he allowed it, because if you notice, like, he's on the poster, Arnold isn't.
I'm interested to see what Red's like, though. I'm really interested to see how Red turns out, but we'll see about that.
Got 2 months to find out.
In fact, that scene establishes what the film should have been and what I thought it was going to be. Stallone and Arnie are established as pros that used to work together, but they parted ways and they don't like each other, yet Willis brings them together for one last job. And, of course, Arnold turns it down and walks off again. And I'm thinking to myself, isn't that what the film should have been? It's supposed to be about these old action stars, you know, who best days are behind them, coming together for one last job, despite their differences. But that doesn't work. The cast they have, they're not even old pros. Statham is a modern action star, so it doesn't even contain that element that these guys are coming back together for one more job. The film's about nothing. Dolph Lundgren, thank God, is the only watchable thing in it, because they gave him something to do.
When he's barely in it.
Yeah, he's barely in it, but at least he has something to do. He has an arc. He plays a crazy, doped-up guy, and, you know, he's basically a liability on the team, and they get rid of him, and then he gets hired by the bad guys. And so,
that was the big issue I had with this movie, to be honest. It's like, granted, like, you know, you accept certain things in your movie, but he clearly died. I know, yeah, spoilers, whatever. Fuck you.
No, this deserves to be spoiled. We want to take people away from
it. He shoots Dolph Lundgren. He goes, where did you shoot me? He goes, just below your heart. He goes, am I dying? I shot you just below the heart. So so that would be a yes, indicating he's going to die. You know, well, tell me what you told the enemies. Okay, and he whispers in his ear or something. And then after they save the day, big shock, there's the big montage. There's the big coda at the end where everyone's getting together and drinking a beer and bullshitting back at the hideout, back at Mickey Rourke's lair, basically. And all of a sudden, there's Dolph Lundgren, like, with a patch over himself, just, you know, shooting the shit at everybody, saying, oh, I'm glad to be back on the team. Wow, you really survived that there. What? What the hell? You just said he died. I don't think that was a reshoot. I think Stallone probably just said, like, fuck it, I'm going to do what I want to do.
He expected us all to be cheering at that point.
Oh, I see.
He actually thought that we'd care, that we'd all like be really touched when Dolph Lundgren dies. I didn't go that far, but I mean, at least he has something to play, and because he's playing this crazy doped up guy, he has an excuse to act badly. The rest of the cast have no excuse, but.
Well, these are not good actors.
Stallone.
Well, I say these are not good actors, but we had Mickey Rourke and Terry Crews, two actors I do like. So we had those two guys. That was it, though. Strike me. And Eric Roberts hamming it up.
Oh, yeah, as usual. That's fine. I like Eric Roberts, but that brings up another thing. Look, if Stallone had managed to put the right hero cast together, even that wouldn't be enough, because this is like his version of Justice League. And so, but what does the Justice League need to go up against? They need the Legion of Doom. and they don't have it here. So what? Who do we have as the villains? We have boring, zero personality dictator guy, rent-a-dictator, if you will. You could get him from a billion movies. They have Eric Roberts and they have Steve Austin. And that's just not enough, I'm afraid. At the very least, get Dan Hayeda to play the dictator, reprising his role from Commando. You need...
Even he said no thanks. Like, I don't know, man. I'm going to go do something else.
Probably, that's a great point, Phil. I got to say, I mean, a lot of people talk about the great, you know, B-action movies, but you know, look at the great, you know, those movies of that genre that we all still remember. The villains had to play a very good role in that. You know, even in something like Commando, you can't forget Dan Hedaya playing a Mexican. So, you know, the fact is, if this was going to be pulled off, they need to get a, you know, they should have had, like, Gary Busey be the villain or something.
Yes.
You needed Gary Busey, you needed Rutger Hauer, you needed Lance Henriksen, Stephen Bierkoff, Malcolm McDowell, Mickey Rourke as the villain, Alan Rickman, Jerry Ryans, Henry Silver, Carl Weathers, Craig T. Nelson, James Woods! That is how you make the ultimate action film. You need antagonists. Michael Ironside, Ronnie Cox. It really, really, really... But you're not telling me you couldn't get at least one of these people, and
maybe they didn't want to work with Stallone. He's not the nicest guy in the world. I mean, I've pretty much heard that from people who worked.
No, I guess so. But even then, it's also about writing the characters they have. It's exactly as Ed said. You need bad guys that are bastards that play for keeps. When we meet the bad guys in Commando, how do we meet them? You know, they've got Arnold on a slab, and then they bring out his daughter and hold a knife to her face, and you're like, okay, these are evil people. We can't wait for them to get their asses kicked. In this, all the dialogue seems to be about the dictator's daughter and how, well, she's my daughter. I don't want to hurt her. Oh, but she's fucking everything up. But she's my daughter. Oh, fuck off. For God's sake. And it's supposed to be the ultimate action movie, but Stallone does not write these kind of movies. He doesn't know how. He tries harder than that, which is fine. He tries to write films with heart and character and films that have something to say. So when he tries to ape this genre, which is admittedly brainless, it totally falls flat on its face. He needs a Steve D'Souza writing this film. Now, say what you want about D'Souza, but that guy knew how to write action films. He knew plot, he knew construction, he knew villains, he knew snappy one-liners. He could write fun. That's the operative word here. This film isn't fun. It's fucking agony. I feel like Steve Martin in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I want fucking action. I want fucking fun. I want fucking good dialogue. I want fucking villains. I want fucking Arnold. Four fucking wheels and a seat. I want a fucking good action film right fucking now.
Bravo.
Yes.
You're fucked. And that's what I would say.
Throw it away. Wait, you're going to stare at me like a slab of meat with mittens? Come on.
Wow. You all right there?
That's the same rant was brought to you by Swanson's Angry Man Dinners.
That's a rant. That's a rant and a half.
Oh, God bless you, Ed. I needed that. I'm all right now.
What else did we see this week?
Yeah, up to you.
Well, I can speak for the three of us here that we all saw Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, the movie that was incorrectly ordained by the internet as being the biggest, bestestest movie ever.
Well, that's not surprising. I'm going to say, though, that this movie, I think, it's definitely going to be, you know, it's still amazing work. I knew it wasn't going to be treated well. A lot of people aren't going to, I think, get it. You know, what a surprise. It's not performing that well at the box office, but I think this is one of those movies.
You would be surprised by saying that, Hawk, and a lot of people, nerdgasm, professional people who know goddamn better, just like got nasty, like, you know, about, well, no, it's going to do great. You don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, yeah, this is you had said is going to be like Kick-Ass, although I think this one thing is a lot better than Kick-Ass, and I think it's going to have more staying power than Kick-Ass. To me, and I refer to a critic I had read in the LA Weekly, had talked about this was basically Watchmen, but it was Watchmen with soul. And I think that comparison to Watchmen is very, very good. This is a movie that's not very approachable to a lot of people, and also much like Watchmen, this is as good as it's going to get. But unlike Watchmen, you know, we had the right people in place. You know, as I said, this is as good as it's going to be, And, you know, this was amazing work by Edgar Wright. I think you couldn't have done any better. There would have been a lot of, you know, possibility for this thing to be garbage. I even think Michael Cera was very good in it.
He was good in it. Everyone was good in this movie. I mean, although I think we can all agree that, like, I was – well, we'll get to this in a minute. But, like, I thought some of the X's were better than others.
Right.
Particularly,
I think that goes with the – unfortunately, and I have read the books because, I mean, the way – how does the movie compare to the books? The movie captures the books, you know, very well. It gets the core. But I can see what you mean, that some of the X's got kind of short-shrifted. In the books, they're more, you know, fleshed out, so to speak. I think the best example I can think of is, and when we're going into spoilers here, is that in regards to Scott involved with Envy Adams, who's the lead singer of Clash at the Demon Head, that's explored very well in the third book. And then also, and that just kind of, you know, she gets very short-shrifted. So it's a bit of a shame. But like I said, it still distilled the books very, very well. And for an hour and 50-minute movie, this thing hauled pretty fast, I'd have to say.
It was a fast-paced movie, but I'm not going to lie to you. Once he got done with the fourth X, who I thought was one of the strong points in terms of the seven villains, I was kind of getting like, all right, I was getting bored. I'm not going to lie to you. I was like, okay, let's get to it. And that's why, you know, they got through the twins very quickly, who I thought were boring. Well, it was funny because you've heard other people say, like, every X was great and they had a moment. It's like, no, you're nerdgasm.
Well,
they did not have a moment.
That
they were...
In the books, the twins have more to do.
Yeah, but talking about in the movie, though. Like, in the movie, they have got nothing to do. They just show up. They don't even really have an active role in the fight against Scott and the band because it's just CG. And it's like, okay, and when you see four other actors who are physically fighting against Michael Cera and Mary Winston, Winstead, you know, then to see, like, oh, just CG there, it's like, well, okay. I didn't find
that. That's a bit of a conceit there. It's probably... Like I said, in the book, they actually do fight, but it's there's more going on. And I think, could they have done that? Yes, but that would have made the movie longer. I mean, it would have made the – I mean, essentially, we would have gotten the Apatow-style length of film here if we had really gotten really into the whole thing of the relationship.
Which we didn't need that. You know, I thought we got enough of the backstory for the characters that I thought – particularly, you know, Ramona. I thought she was actually – in terms of the best casting, I walked out really liking Winstead. Kieran Culkin. I actually walked out really liking.
Well, Kieran Culkin was great.
He was
as, Wallace Wells, and also I would definitely say the girl that played Knives Chow. She was definitely a real highlight of the film. She really had presence, and you know, you always enjoyed her time. She looked great,
and you kind of just like. And I guess the ultimate point is it's kind of like similar to weird comparison, but Two Lovers, where you kind of look at you know the other girl. And you kind of look at the lead character and go, what the fuck is wrong with you? You know, because, like, you can kind of see, like, you know, she's really sweet. Like, it's easy to see why he initially fell for her, but the way he just kind of, not that he disregards her, but he's just, not that he doesn't care for her, but it's just he's embarrassed by her. Like, I'm 22 and I'm dating a 17-year-old, as opposed to, you know, every character gives him shit about it. Like, oh, you're babysitting, you know?
Yes.
I don't know. It was who was the best X amongst you guys? I thought in terms of the strengths of the X's, I would say no question it was in no particular order. I'd say Chris Evans, Brandon Routh, and Mae Whitman were the best. Like they walked off in terms of the villains. Like wow, they were great.
What did you think, Phil?
He didn't see it.
Phil and
Hulk,
I think,
Hulk not see Scott Pilgrim. Hulk stay home.
No. We don't get it till the 27th, unfortunately. I'm
okay. I
enjoy Brendan Routh.
Yeah. Go ahead, Lou.
I like Brendan Routh the best of the exes, and the first guy was good too. I'm sorry, I don't know his name, but
I didn't care for him either. I thought I was into it, and then all of a sudden he goes into a musical number, and I was like, out. I have to be honest.
Yeah, that was on it. When I saw that, it's like, yeah, a lot of this is going to. Pull out a lot of people because there's a Bollywood dance number. I'm like, yeah, this movie is one odd duck.
You're going with it with a visual style. He flies up. They start fighting. Okay, fine. But then, yeah, he starts Bollywood dancing and singing. Okay.
I think that's all from the first book, too, actually.
Yeah. Well, still, I
like that. I didn't mind that at all.
no, it wasn't a distraction. It's just, I mean, I could see why this is not very approachable, which is a shame because... The center core of all of the relationships is very, very relatable.
Exactly. Like, this movie is marketed totally wrong in
my
mind.
It was horribly marketed. That's why when I saw, like, the Masters of the Web panel,
this
I was...
like a John Hughes movie. That's how it should have been marketed, in my mind.
The first trailer, I thought... I actually liked the first trailer. I mean, I know you didn't like it, Lou, but...
Yeah, it didn't make any sense.
Fair enough. But, like, the other trailers, like, particularly that second one, is almost like Universal kind of threw up their hands and said, like, we know we're not going to make money off this, so we're just going to sell it to nerds. That second trailer was absolute geek nirvana. It didn't even try to sell it to other people. The ad campaign was fucking horrible. So to hear people whine and bitch and moan saying, like, what happened? To go, did you really expect this movie to make money? Because I saw it this weekend, obviously. Nobody was there.
I saw it on Friday. I mean, I saw it with a very big crowd, but you could tell this was the crowd that was going to see it.
And they're saying, like, the criticisms people are getting so personal if you don't like it, and it's like, this is not going to be for everybody. That's very easy to tell.
Gets people mad is the fact that I think some people say, what is this? Is some sort of hipster nonsense? And I think that's very – some of the criticism is very lazy.
I agree.
That's what gets people aggravated.
But yeah, I will say, though, at the same time, the defense is equally lazy. In fact, it's even more so because the hipster thing, I never bought into that, so I agree with you. But it's just
– I always thought – there's not not to cut you off there.
No, go ahead.
Like, I always thought it's like, well, it's a movie about people in their 20s. People in their 20s have no money. So, yeah, it's going to look cheap and well and really worn out. And, there's – and all that sort of thing. To me, when I saw this movie, I thought this is our generation's Reality Bites. This sums up everything that is about our generation of kids of the – born of the – the mid to late – early – basically of the 80s and even the early 90s. So I think you look at that and so, yeah, is the film going to be dated in respect? Yeah, because it's going to be a perfect snapshot of what life was all about, in this time period. Of this decade, essentially.
My issue is, like, we talk about how people are being lazy with the criticism and getting just stupid, vicious, but the thing that pisses me off is, like, people saying, like, well, you just don't get it. You're just too old. Bullshit. Like, and Lou, I mean, you're here, you're older than us, and, you bought, like, a Nintendo when it came out. Like, you remember the hugeness. It's like, you got the references, you like the movie. It's not an age thing. It's just, this is not going to be for everybody. It's not about age. Fuck you, asshole. Get a real excuse. It's like, I got the references.
If you like movies about people, as young adults struggling to find their identity, and which is what most of the John Hughes movies or even like Rebel Without a Cause, like the story in this movie is pretty basic. It's about people trying to make connections with other people when they're trying to figure out who they are. And the only thing different about this movie is that there's more technology and pop culture and social media, which has become much more intertwined into people's lives. So it changes that from that perspective, but at its core, it's really the same old story that's been going on since movies came out as far as young people trying to make connections with other people. I thought there's some really funny stuff in here, like the instantaneous feedback that you get. Like, basically, there's a couple of scenes with Kieran Culkin. He's the instant messenger king. He's basically texting in his sleep, so the guy, poor Scott Pilgrim's getting feedback from his friends on the relationship status before he even has time to process it himself at some times. Like, it's quite hilarious. I think it's quite funny how it makes fun of the stuff that we're getting so used to on the internet with the instant feedback and that. And this is a movie for people that's young at heart. I really think that Edgar Wright did an amazing job with this movie. He sets it up beautifully. Like, the first bit is really, like, he's just setting up the style. You're getting used to the quick jump cuts and the edits where people are talking to you, but then when they move away, it's right into another scene. So you kind of get into that, and the rhythm of the movie gets going, and then the first X comes, and then he lets, the shackles off, and then it goes into the crazy edits and the Bollywood dances and all that stuff. But at that point, you're kind of like, okay, I'm getting it. I understand what he's doing here. Like, I never thought he'd lost control of the picture. I followed it. Because it's not a difficult story to follow. I never got lost with where things are happening.
It's easy to follow. My feeling is, like, it's so overwhelming in terms of the visuals,
the
gags, the characters, the references. So when I hear people say, like, I've seen it two times already, three times, I go, man, I had to process it. Not that it's easy to follow, but it's a lot. I think it's a good movie. I do not think it's a great movie. Maybe it will be better on second viewing, but I don't think it's Edgar Wright's best movie. I mean, I immediately love Shaun of the Dead. I
like
immediately
said, I wouldn't say it's his best movie, but like I said, he was the perfect man for the job.
I don't, I couldn't imagine
work on Spaced.
Yeah,
because to me they go hand in hand. So, and like I said, this could have been botched so many ways.
Oh yeah.
Like as I had said, this is as good as it's going to get with this kind of movie. And the fact that
I'm sorry. Well,
go ahead, Luke.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was just saying. I mean, the fact that, like I said, I know there was a lot of reservation about Michael Cera in the main role. I mean, the thing is, when you look at the character Scott Pilgrim, and I'm impressed when you look at the book, and then you look at the characters that they were able to cast a lot of people that look like the characters. Well, the character of Scott Pilgrim is so amorphous looking. It's just like you're not going to get anyone that looks like that. Same thing with Wallace Wells, oddly enough. You can't get anyone that looks exactly like Wallace Wells. It's not feasible. So, like I said, Sarah was great. And I think, and a lot of people are hung up on the fact that Sarah kind of plays a nebbish kind of character and, you know, in his other stuff. And
look, there's a lot of people you could say that about, and I'm not going to lie. There are moments in this movie where he is doing the Sarah thing, but they're few and far between, and even something like Lost in Translation where Bill Murray's playing a different character, there are moments where he's being Bill Murray in that movie. So I'm not going to beat that horse. Now, it's true that people – one of the reasons this movie bombed is because they're sick of Michael Cera, and they can't process that either, some of these people who are in love with this movie, saying, oh, well, but those movies didn't go – those last couple of movies people didn't go see. They didn't go see him for a reason because they didn't want to see Michael Cera. They're tired of the guy. But he does a really good job here. He is playing something different. I like the other guys. Will Ferrell is being something – he's doing something different here, but yet there are moments where he's being Will Ferrell. That's normal. I mean, I don't know how that's a shock to people if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Like,
right. I definitely couldn't have – there couldn't have been anyone that would have done it better. So
I agree with you.
Let's be honest here. It probably got made because he – I mean, at the time, you know, wasn't he coming off like two huge hits with Superman and Juno? So that him signing on to do it probably meant this movie got made at the time with that kind of budget.
I still think Edgar – it was all about Edgar Wright carrying this thing.
Maybe.
Yeah,
in that case.
I definitely don't think too. It wasn't just Edgar Wright had been championing this thing. He went for it. I don't believe it wasn't Sarah that said, I want to do this. I think it was Edgar Wright, and then he pulled Sarah into it. And because you saw how enthused Edgar Wright was for this project. I think it was definitely all
absolutely
on his shoulders.
Well, I mean, we bring on the Kick-Ass comparison, which is in a number of other films, but it I really do wonder, like, what does Edgar Wright do after this? Because this is a big bomb on his hands. And you go, what is – I wonder if, like Kick-Ass, he does something safe next. I mean, something that can – he can do something that can appeal to his style. He can make something worthwhile with, but will be something that will give him some money and will get him a little bit of clout. Because guess what? I mean, Shaun of the Dead didn't do well, really. Neither did Hot Fuzz, state-wise, and then but those weren't expensive, so they did okay, and they did huge on home video. This movie is a huge bomb. I mean, it was $100 million budget.
If I can just chime in on
I really think
and believe me, but I don't want to sound like an arrogant ass.
No.
Like his career advice agent.
That is me. Don't worry.
No, not at all.
Zing.
But I do think the worst thing he could do at this point is pull a Brad Bird, for example, and direct Mission Impossible 5. I don't want him to I mean, obviously, I'm not. Yeah. That doesn't really stretch because obviously Brad Bird's not coming off a flop. But you understand, I don't want him taking some safe studio job.
I doubt he's going to do that.
I don't know. I don't know. I would not be surprised. I'm just.
The best
thing
for him to do is go back, finish the Cornetto trilogy.
The Ice Cream Trilogy, is that what it's called?
The Ice Cream Trilogy. That's what Blood and Ice Cream Trilogy, whatever you want to call it. Just finish that. Just do what he wants to do, because at the end of the day, I feel like we place too much emphasis on box office and stuff, understandably so, because that's what everyone's talking about. But still, the only thing that matters.
Well, it matters because we want these movies to do well. The general public will like them.
But
the important thing
is that the man is a quality filmmaker. From what you're telling me, his streak is not damaged here.
No, he's three for oh.
This is a virtuoso performance because he's really juggling some you know pretty off the wall video styles and edit cuts here, and I would even go the fight with the twins might have not, you know, there might be a little bit of fatigue going in there, but he crammed so much in there. Like when I was watching that fight, I thought, boy, this reminds me of the Id Monster from Forbidden Planet. So like, there's all these cool little things, and the fight balloons, like the old Adam West beat Batman TV show. It, like he never he's throwing all this stuff in, but the movie never loses its narrative thrust. And the thing I loved about the movie the most is at the end of this movie, all the characters have grown. And not just Scott Pilgrim and Ramona and Knives, but all the characters around them as well. They've all kind of come to some sort of, mini
catharsis
about, you know, what they're doing with their lives. And in some cases, it's really small. But everybody in this movie that's a friend of Scott Pilgrim or rotates around him, they've all grown in some form. And I think it's a virtuoso performance for a director, and the writing is solid. I mean, I don't know the graphic novels at all. I don't know if they carry that same kind of through line through the stories. I mean, maybe if there was a sequel and they did the next movie, this would all be reset, and he might be doing the whole thing over again. I have no idea.
Scott Pilgrim versus the Universe.
Well, there's not going to be a sequel. That's because it ends the way there's six books. That's it. That's how there is no sequel here. It's contingent on Brian Lee O'Malley making more stuff, but there's no reason to. It ends the way, you know, it ends perfectly. There's no reason to go beyond, what we have here. So, like I said, there's not going to be a sequel movie, and there's definitely not going to be a seventh book, unless it's some sort of money grab. Like I said, I don't believe this is going to hurt Edgar Wright at all. I think Edgar Wright definitely, you know, can work with a lower budget. And I think he's obviously going to have staying power. And even then, this is a great addition to his library. Because I stand by the fact, like Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead, there's gonna be staying power for this movie. People are always gonna refer to this movie. Like I said, this is the Reality Bites of this generation. So if anyone, you know, and I think people of our generation and then are gonna look on this, you know, are gonna, you know, be wrapped up on this film. And I think other people are gonna want to see, you know, what were the kids of the day, you know, enjoying at the time. Of, you know, in this period of, you know, in this, you know, decade or year, and they're going to refer to Scott Pilgrim, either the books or...
I don't know about that. I think that movie statements like that, with all due respect, it's like someone preordained, like, okay, this is going to be the movie people are going to remember. I don't know. It's always the ones you don't expect, the ones that make the impact. Right. As we said off air, Star Wars was expected to bomb. Everyone in Hollywood said, oh, yeah, that movie's fucking terrible. It's going to make no money. Let's put our movie right after it. It became phenomenal. It changed Hollywood.
But a lot Shawshank, of movies,
Shawshank Redemption, a movie that nobody ignored when it came out. And it was not till home video that people started – I mean, people were saying that they didn't understand the title. They knew it was set in prison, so they thought it was going to be about gang rape. It was based on a Stephen King novel, so they assumed it was going to be a horror film.
Well, it was for 10 minutes.
Well, he's got a point there.
Yeah, he does actually. I'm befuddled. He got me there.
I still think it's a great calling card just to see how, because if you find someone that liked that movie or likes or knows about the movie or the books, then you know and you're into that sort of stuff. It's a great way to, you know, it's a great, you know, reception point, I guess. So it's like, you know, this is someone who would know what you're talking about. Probably be a good person to make friends with. As I said, a lot of movies. You're right. You don't know about years down the line, but. You know, say like a movie like True Romance or even like Blade Runner. Yeah, it takes a while, but
and that movie took forever. Blade Runner took forever to be. I mean, like it was not immediate. I mean, so it's just there's no telling if it's going to be Scott Pilgrim. I mean, I'm just saying. I mean, I don't want people. I think people are getting a little bit too lost in this internet hype. That's my problem with this movie. It's not even related to the movie. It's just this attitude that people have been giving about it for months now. It's like, you don't know if it's going to be received. You need to shut up and let the public decide.
Even if it's not received, you still know there's going to be that core of people. We're not talking about a very, you know, this isn't like Southland Tales we're talking about.
No,
this is a movie that I think
it's good. That's the difference.
Revered. You know, I think it's going to be around.
Well, I mean, you know. You compare it to Southland Tales, but I mean that's basically coming off of a, with all due respect, a one-hit wonder like Richard Kelly. Right. And really, you might not even call him a one-hit wonder since, as you know, Donnie Darko didn't do well when it came out. So
it caught a lot of stuff, but then when he redid it, he screwed his own pooch.
And this is not a case of like shitting on Richard Kelly. We're just giving an example here. Randy Wright's got three good movies under his belt, and
that's the thing.
Yeah.
I think this one shows his director skills off the best. And I totally agree with you, Jamie. Like, you can't manufacture this kind of phenomenon. I mean, for me, like, if I look at the San Diego Comic Con, the thing that stands out for me still the most was something spontaneous, and was just that clip with that little boy at the Green Lantern panel with Ryan Reynolds when he asked him to quote the
right.
Niner oath. Like,
that kid was actually 40.
You can't buy that stuff. You can't
that kid was 40 years old, actually. He was the studio plant.
Oh, okay, yeah. the bottom line with this
Yeah, movie, I know. That was a bad joke. I couldn't help it. Go ahead.
The bottom line, Scott Pilgrim, it's a fun movie. I'm maybe a little bit of Phil's rubbing off on me now, but I think all this ageism and internet stuff is a bunch of crap. It's a fun movie. Just go see it and let the chips fall where they may, because I'm over 30 and I enjoyed the movie. So I don't believe any of this stuff about ageism and internet.
That's so right? bullshit.
You know?
And the one thing
I movie, bottom line.
And I will say one thing I want to say is, please, you know, the movie is not going to be in theaters that long by this number. Yeah. It's not. I would say, usually, even the movies I like, I say, you can wait for video. I would say, no, man, go see it in the big screen. Go see it with the surround sound, the big silver screen. You should see it at least once in that. I would urge people to try to see it in theaters. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be around long. Everyone's now trying. The spin machine now from our colleagues is, well, it's going to be around because word of mouth. Nope. It bombed this weekend. It's going to lose screens immediately. And more movies are coming out, so go see it immediately.
And the final note I want to make is to Edgar Wright, is just to say that I really just hope and pray that some stupid studio exec doesn't talk him into taking some assignment, just some shooting assignment, where he's forced into this horrible position of maybe saying, well, I can't make a great movie out of this, but at least I'll be making a movie that people will see on opening weekend. In other words, what I'm translating here is, for the love of God, Edgar, do not make Ant-Man next. That is the worst thing you could possibly do. Do not make a movie for Marvel next. Go back and do your own thing.
Oh, I think
making good movies.
After this movie's opening weekend numbers, I don't think Ant-Man's going to happen. I'd be shocked if it does.
I didn't think it was going to happen much at all, but you never know.
True.
But still, because they do. I mean, I'll give Marvel their due. Sometimes they do let talented filmmakers just make a movie.
Well, Ant-Man is so random.
Yeah, but wouldn't that cost a lot of money to produce, though? It's like it's a C-rate Marvel character who is going to require a big budget, and you know that's why I go like, I don't know if they're going to make this now. If Scott Pilgrim had been a bigger hit, then it would have happened. But
was it just me or did Kieran Culkin, did he remind you of a young Robert Downey Jr. at all in that movie?
He did.
I was like, holy shit, I feel like I'm watching, what was that movie he did in the 80s, Zero Hour with...
Less Than Zero?
Less Than Zero?
Yeah.
No, he was good in Less Than Zero, but...
Yeah.
That character was completely different, but I could see maybe young. I could see what you're saying, maybe from like Robert Downey Jr. and Back to School or something.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, okay, better example. Thanks. Yeah, I was like, whoa.
Just because Kieran Culkin doesn't die of a cocaine overdose at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
Nor does he.
I said no spoilers, damn it.
Yeah, exactly. You'll enjoy this movie though, Phil. It's a good movie.
I'm glad.
I mean, moving on, we got a couple of brief topics, and I mean brief. I mean, these aren't going to take long. Phil, you wanted to talk about the Star Wars Blu-ray?
Yes, sir. Obviously, it's not exactly a secret. We all knew it was coming. Yes, sir. We'll be taking donations at the end. A PayPal link will be sent. Send money to Edgar. He'll be fine. So yes, it's no secret. Star Wars is coming to Blu-ray, of course. That it's going to be a big set of all six films. So if you don't want the prequel trilogy, luck. Old guy. He doesn't get it. He doesn't appreciate the prequels, man. So, well, no one does. But they've confirmed that they're coming out for Blu-ray next year as a special treat. They confirmed there'll be lots of extra little goodies, things we didn't even know exist, and they showed a wonderful little Return of the Jedi deleted scene.
I gotta say, I just saw that scene. I think it was either Jamie or Phil just sent that. I mean, God, this is the one thing I never could understand about Star Wars. It's like the barest of scraps, and you would think... And mass orgasm occurs.
Yes.
This is why I could never get into Star Wars. That scene doesn't contribute anything to the plot.
It doesn't. It's just one of those things
he
hear.
The goddamn lightsaber. That's it.
Yeah.
No, this is the thing.
It's just we've heard about that scene for years. We've heard about that scene for years, and we've seen the storyboards, And you're absolutely right with what you say, by the way, Hawken. I'm not disagreeing with you. But it's just like I never thought the scene was filmed. It was never really clear. Also, it was a storyboard from it. We heard about it. And it sounded like the kind of redundant scene, like, nah, they didn't shoot that. And then all of a sudden you look at it and it's like, holy shit, there it is. Like, fuck a duck. It's around. And, of course, in typical Lucas fashion, here we are. We're not going to put it out for the DVD from 2004. No, fuck that. We're going to put it out for the Blu-ray for – when's it coming out, like this November?
It's next. It's 2011. They say fall 2011, a little bit ill.
Fall 2011?
No, there you go. Firm date yet. Yeah.
No, fucker. But it's – it might maybe it might be September 2011, like the original.
Basically a year from now.
Pretty much,
roughly,
yeah. But of course, as we all immediately, as soon as it was announced, there was speculation about whether we'd be getting the original versions of the original films. Ha ha! Of course not. What folly, you fools! No, we won't be getting that. You are going to be getting the special editions. Now, Mitch on the site wrote an article about this. Mm-hmm. Go check it out, folks. And he put a statement there saying, "Well, who cares? I'm going to be buying it, same as you." Now, I don't know if Mitch was being playful about that or not, but just in case,
a lot of people.
Let me tell you, Mitch, you're wrong. I'm not buying it. I have had enough. And I'll tell you why, folks. And this is getting back to something we were talking about a couple of weeks ago when we had our debate about home media and its place and things now. I'll tell you, a Blu-ray represents, to me, a thing for film connoisseurs, for film collectors who want the original films that they love preserved, and that's the key word, preserved and presented in their original form with the best quality and sound and audio and all of that shit. And that's not happening here. You know, we're just getting... And also, I mean, you know, I hate to say this, but maybe he's not done yet. I do know that the puppet Yoda in Phantom Menace is going to be replaced with computer
really?
Yoda. Yes. Yeah. No. So,
well, the thing of why, and I'll never get into Star Wars, just because Lucas will continue to reho the same plot of land over and over and over and over again. We've now reached to the point now a dust bowl has developed, and is now it's like this is just nothing. This is complete dust, and it's ridiculous.
See, this is why people are afraid of Peter Jackson directing The Hobbit, whatever decade that comes out. It's because you're in fear of Lucas. You just think, like, you know, the guy tried some things outside of the rings, and, you know, I loved King Kong. I know a lot of people didn't. Obviously, Lovely Bones, nobody liked, and I was, you know, a terrible movie.
Don't make me bring that up again. I'm as angry as this.
Yeah, I know, but you get my point, though. It's like, okay, here we go. You know, he's going back to the well because everything else didn't work out.
It's, well, I'm immune to it at this point. It's a part for the course that he does these things. The only thing I'll say about it is, look, to answer Ed's point, I'll admit it, I'm as guilty of that orgasming as anybody else. You know, if it's something you grew up with, something you love, and you find out there's something there that you never knew existed,
yeah,
or you would speculate it, you get excited. So I saw that scene, and I didn't go, yeah, oh! Like the people in the
you're
crowd
British.
There. Well,
yeah, exactly. You're quiet when you watch a movie. You don't make noise.
But I watched it and I was like, oh, wow, new footage. That's really fucking cool, man. And I see where that would have been in the movie and, you know, immediately thinking about, well, should that have been in the movie or should not? It's fun. But as Jamie said to me off air, all this stuff's going to be on YouTube. If I'm going to buy the Blu-ray, and this would be the case anyway if YouTube didn't exist or not, if I'm going to buy the Blu-ray, it's going to be because of the films.
Yeah, you can't buy for a new scene. That's pretty much buying a new action figure because it has a hat.
Quoting the Simpsons.
I'm guilty of that in the 80s.
This Malibu Stacey is just as shallow. Yeah, just as shallow as the other ones, but it has a new hat. I want to.
Years after this release, the original ones will be released anyhow.
Oh, absolutely, because he did that with the other trilogies. I mean, with the DVDs, so yeah.
And that actually opens up a greater ethical issue for me, is that if he does that, will I buy it then? Or should I make a stand and say I'm not giving him my money? I just wonder if there's anyone else out there who feels the same way as I do, who feels like they've had enough. Like, it's not fair anymore. And you've got to stop eating Lucas's table scraps.
I think they did. Let's be fair. I think they kind of did, though. I mean, they rejected the animated Star Wars movie, so they did.
Ah, no, we're talking about something different here, dude. That was rejected because it looked shit. Okay, we're talking
true.
About...
That's true.
We're talking about Star Wars on Blu-ray. We've been waiting for this.
I mean,
the original trilogy, they look so wonderful. I mean, they always look great. And if there's a chance to make them look even better, like watch the Battle of Hoth or the Return of Jedi Space Battle in high definition Blu-ray, yeah, I'm a sucker.
I don't know. As we've seen with all these high def transfers, it makes the movie look worse. So it's like, maybe we should just leave it alone. Maybe we don't need a high def everything on this Blu-ray crap.
That's a good point as well.
You know,
we don't know how it's going to look. That's very true.
But although Lucas will just throw money at it.
It's coming out next year, and folks, by all means, damn my soul to hell if I turn around and end up buying it. But I'm telling you right now, if he's doing this, if he's just giving out those special editions, which I am not a member of originaltrilogy.com here. I want to make that perfectly clear. I'm not signing petitions or anything. I'm just fed up. You know,
Online petitions really mean something.
Yeah. Make sure to send them some random object that, you know, and you'll get a lot of it in the mail.
Yeah. What would you send George Lucas? Like torn off like lumberjack shirts and shit? I mean, you. Oh, okay. Yeah. There you go.
Well, it's the same thing like we went through this year with Lord of the Rings on Blu-ray. Not the extended editions on them. I'm not buying them either until they come out. So this is kind of more of the same thing.
Exactly. And he's, you know, who knows, maybe he's going to, you know, the scenes we see of Gollum in Fellowship of the Ring, it looks different than the Gollum in 2000 Return of the King.
Right.
Maybe he's going to change it. Maybe he's going to fuck around with it.
I don't think so. I will say that about Jackson. He doesn't seem to, you know, he did the extended editions, but it's like, you know, that was just for the fans, and there was a lot of careful... They didn't just throw every deleted scene in there. I mean, they actually made a point to say, well, we're going to edit this like we would a normal movie. We're not just going to throw deleted scenes in there. So, I mean, I wouldn't worry about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just, I guess.
Well, basically, you're never going to get Tom Bombadil. That's never going to happen, so.
Well, I mean, not that they ever shot it. I mean, I don't think they did.
Yeah, that too.
No, they didn't.
No, they never shot it. That was completely cut.
Next year we're going to get a YouTube video of some celebration. You're going to see Tom Bombadil scene. Yeah! Woo!
Oh! Well, at least I can understand that. That would be a major scene. That's not just 2 seconds. Some guy fixing a sword.
You know? Yeah. No, it is. It is. That's exactly what it's going to be. They're going to walk past him. It's going to be John Goodman as Tom Bombadil. And just goes, hey, hello. That's what it's going
to
be.
And they just
Sean
Connery. Go back to what they're doing.
Exactly.
Sean Connery, there you go. Let's see, wrapping up the news items this week real briefly. We've heard about this for a while. I mean, they've already filmed it. It's been sort of misidentified saying it's a Pixar production. It's not, actually. It's a Disney production of John Carter of Mars, directed by Andrew Stanton, starring...
Yeah! Woo! Woo!
I must say, I'm looking forward to it a lot when it comes out. We knew it was coming out for 2012, but they never gave a specific date, but they've announced it was going to be for... Was it June 8th, I believe, is the correct date for John Carter of Mars? Early June 2012 it's going to hit.
It's
so,
June. That's the important thing. It's June.
That's going to be a pretty stuffed summer. I mean, like, that's going to be a lot of big movies hitting that year. Since it's the last year, you know, of humanity, as we all know. might as well live it up.
Got to get that product out the door.
That's right. I'm actually looking forward to seeing how this movie looks. I mean, it's the same thing as like Avatar and Scott Pilgrim, where they weren't giving us any idea how this was going to look. They didn't start like sending out little pictures and stuff. They basically held off on that for the longest time. I know it's going to be it's going to be live action mixed in with a lot of motion capture work. If you've seen any images from the Edgar Burroughs pulp novels and the comic books that came out subsequently, I mean, I'm curious how this is going to be visualized.
Well, Frank Frazetta paintings, which is what I think of when I think
here.
Of John
Carter. Yeah, like the Conan and John Carter paintings are kind of intertwined.
Well, also, and then that animated thing. Remember on the internet, like they were going to do not unlike the Max Fleischer Superman shorts, they were going to do it for John Carter, and there's tests online that look pretty good, you know, them sort of showing how it would have looked and whatnot. I mean, it's pretty interesting stuff.
Considering it's like 100 years old, yeah.
And as you can hear right now, Phil's typing, looking for that, you know, frantically.
No, I'm not. I swear, no, I saved my typing till after the show. But this is actually one of the things about doing our show, that every week Jamie shows me cool links to shit every week. Last time, this is what we do every week, so I'm sure we'll be doing that when we're finished.
Yeah, like when I sent the Reading Rainbow in slow motion. That's one of my favorites on my YouTube account. Phil was like, that is disturbing. I said, yeah, that's why I thought it was funny. Someone decided to take the opening to Reading Rainbow and in very slow motion, and it reads like someone's reading the Necronomicon from The Evil Dead. That's what it played like. That's what I thought. Someone should cut that, you know, footage from The Evil Dead to, like, playing that song. You know, join us, butterflies in the sky.
I think Shyamalan has found his next film.
There you go. In that Shyamalan's Reading Rainbow. He'll play the LeVar Burton part.
Yeah.
The only thing I wanted to mention about John Carter of Mars is the same thing as you, Jamie, that we were talking about this last week in Speculating, and I wondered whether they would. And by the way, I'm going to stay firm on this, that regardless of the film Andrew Stanton makes, as far as Disney's marketing department are concerned, this is Avatar 2. This is the next Avatar. They are going to market it exactly like that. So I wondered whether they were going to take the Avatar slot in mid-December. I'm still not sure.
Which is where Man of Steel is right now. You know,
that's exactly where it is. Right. Is Sherlock Holmes 2 coming out for Christmas 2012?
2011. It's December 16th, 2011. That's going up against. That's actually going up. That's going to be an interesting Christmas. That's going up against Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Mission Impossible 4. And another one of those goddamn chipmunk movies.
Uh-huh. Maybe 2012 we'll have the next Bond film. Here's hoping.
You will see that quicker than you see The Hobbit. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I'll see that gladly. My only concern was that, yes, 2012 looks very, very crowded. I have no doubt if it's a great movie, then they will come and they will see it over.
Hopefully. I don't know. I don't even know about that. I'm worried. I know it's so early, but you go, you know, the influence of Edgar Burroughs is in Avatar. Cameron's acknowledged that. You wonder if audiences aren't aware of that, though. That doesn't mean audiences are stupid. They just don't know. They're not aware of that. So you go, are they going to say, is this an Avatar ripoff? That's not out of the question.
Yeah, we could definitely lead into a possible another Scott Pilgrim-like situation here.
Where
we're going to have a very good movie, but not a lot of people are going to going to see it. I mean, I have never even read John Carter of Mars. We're talking some very old pulp material here. I mean, this is basically, and I hate to, I'm about to pull a Dennis Miller here, but this would be like having an Alan Quatermain movie. I mean, this would be huge news if this was 1913. But, you know, it's not.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, you know, which they actually are doing. You say that. They actually are doing an Alan Quatermain movie in space, apparently. So,
oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, exactly. With Sean Connery. No, it might as well be.
The important thing is, though, that this is John Carter Mars has been, people have been waiting for this one for a while.
This has been talked about for a long time.
Really? Yeah. I'm glad that they're getting it.
The influence is all over the place. A lot of stuff, so it's interesting to finally see the real McCoy getting the adaptation. And with, dare I say, a really fucking great supporting cast. I mean, Taylor Kitsch is a good actor. I've seen him on Friday Night Lights. But, like, you know, you've got Thomas Hayden Church and Willem Dafoe, Dominic West, Cillian Hines is in it.
Mark Strong.
Mark Strong. Ryan Cranston's in it. It's like, okay, get excited.
Oh my goodness.
Get excited for this supporting cast. I mean, this is a good
cast. We should just make up some names at this point. Brian Dennehy's in it, and Tom, what's his name?
Patton Oswalt's in it.
Tom Bosley.
John
Hammond. Tom Fisher, Jason Mewes, they're all in it. Everybody's in it.
Oh, that would be funny. But Kevin Smith would be in it, you know.
Yes. We've got nothing to really say about it. And another thing we were talking about how is that the difference perhaps between Andrew Stanton and Jon Favreau is that Jon Favreau likes to talk to fans on the internet. He uses the internet. He likes to keep us informed about stuff. Doesn't spoil too much, but he does like to show us stuff, which I think, you know, it's sometimes a good thing.
Yeah.
But I prefer not to be shown a damn thing, especially if it's a movie that I'm going to see anyway. It's Andrew Stanton. I'm there. So I hope he is the kind of guy who's just not going to show us
dick. Hey, let's be honest here. The last three geek properties, you know, it was basically the two Nolan Batmans, Avatar and the Star Trek reboot, and the internet kind of, you know, the filmmakers didn't bother to even try to get the internet involved. They said, I'm making my movie. Leave me alone. We'll talk about that shit later once we're in post. I mean, so... That's probably that's not a wrong approach.
I hope you're right. I really hope you're right. So that's it for the news. We're going to pass the baton over to Lou now, because it's time for the big debate with Lou. He's got an idea. What are we talking about, Lou?
We're talking about the future of cinema and what properties or genres are going to be viable going forward as we see, right? Well, if we look at the box office this week, you've got kind of, at one end, you've got Inception, which is kind of a mixed bird, doing great box office, and I'll get into that a little bit further. But then on the other hand, you've got like the Scott Pilgrim, which is a pretty unique property, but is bombing by, you know, by
big margins.
Big margins in the cinema. So it seems that cinema, all the good drama, at least from my perspective, seems to be going to TV, or the vast majority of it. Whereas with cinema, it's becoming much more of a brand item thing, whether it be a franchise or a director, which is why Inception is such a great example, because it's kind of straddling both worlds. I mean, it's a difficult property to quantify or to label to a genre.
But to market.
But the director has got a brand name. Everybody knows who Chris Nolan is. So his, you know, is this picture doing well because it's such a great movie?
Or I'm not so sure. Well, I'm not so certain. Nolan's. I don't know if Nolan's a brand name just yet.
I think after The Dark Knight, he's a brand name.
I would say after this, he's a brand name now, to be honest. I really would, because it's like he finally got something out of
it. Solidified it, yeah.
After Batman, because, I mean, all you could say is, well, yeah, but look at, I mean, like, example, like, Tim Burton became a brand name after Batman, but it's like Joel Schumacher didn't, if that makes any sense. Like, Nolan's, I think he's a brand name now. Because of Inception, because Inception was well marketed. Let's be honest here. I mean, there was a lot. They had a lot of really great images. It was intriguing to people, and you had an actor who everyone likes. He has a iffy track record commercially, but people don't hate Leonardo DiCaprio. They love the guy. He's a great actor, so that helped also. I don't know.
I know people who see his movies because he's in them.
Yeah,
Shutter Island did really well over here he's in it.
He's coming off. DiCaprio's having a very good year. Shutter Island was a big hit. This was a fucking monster, Inception. I mean, it's going to...
Since he took a percentage on his picture instead of his upfront salary.
He did. Smart man.
Oh, man. That's the best.
Oof. Yeah. Smart man. No, but to your point, though, I don't know. I mean, you're right about television. It is... But I don't know. I mean...
I think what
I was trying to say, though, about drama, because a lot of the good dramas on TV are really able to expand and get out there. You have the quality really focused on that, just to give things time, to allow characters build, to allow stories develop. You don't really have that in film. And is it possible we could have a resurgence, maybe at some point, of what happened in the 70s? It's possible. I mean, this thing of like, because I used to read books that were written by Peter Bart, and who was a former... I think the president of Paramount, he was also the editor-in-chief of Variety at one point. He would always decry and moan of, like, the state of the movie industry today and, you know, and things like that. And then I'd read some time ago, I'd actually even read a book. It was about Ronald Reagan's film career. And even then, the whole idea of remakes and franchises and, you know, doing the same thing over and over and over, that existed even then. Now, the structure of the studios was different and, you know, things like that, but this mentality of doing the same thing over and over again, the lazily done movies, catering to, so-called stupid people, that's always been around.
Yeah.
But just obviously the tastes have changed, and even when studios were independent companies and they were their own fiefdoms, we're still always looking for the quick buck, the easy answer, but there was that mentality that doesn't really exist, where there was that side of the business that really was exploring, you know, the art. I think, though, that it's always going to be around. It's not going to be, you know, it just may not be as explored or may not be as highlighted on. I don't know. So,
I've noticed is it might be, I could be wrong, but I think from my perspective, it's a perception. Because obviously I don't see every movie that comes out, and I don't watch every genre that comes out, because I don't like horror films. But every time you go to the movies, you see a trailer you'll see a trailer for a horror film probably, you'll see one for a comedy, you'll see one for a rom-com, and every single one of these trailers looks exactly the same. And so it's just, you just get the feeling.
Saying that this is nothing new, it's just unfortunately much more apparent, especially when there are years... when there's just nothing out there, and when it's just a lot of garbage out there. And I know
the two things that are always going to stay the same is that, and also they're going to want to make movies to win Academy Awards.
You know, what those movies are like, because they're typically the same thing every year. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, you know,
play somebody with a disease and you're going to get an Oscar
nomination. Play someone famous and with a disease, or that they're mentally challenged, or all three. Although it didn't work for it worked for Jeffrey Rush and Shine. You hit a trifecta. Yeah, so.
He did, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a triumph over the odds. It's always, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Which is not a new thing, though. Triumph over the odds, that's a universal thing. It's always, yeah. Which is, you know, we always enjoy those things.
Which is why, as people always say, which is why Rocky beat Taxi Driver for Best Picture that, you know, in 76.
It's also why Forrest Gump beat Pulp Fiction
and Shawshank.
There's no way a film like Pulp Fiction, which is obviously the better movie, that there's no way that would have won Best Picture.
Absolutely not. I think Bastards could have won last year, actually, and it seriously could have pulled it off if it not been for Hurt Locker.
You had a movie like The Hurt Locker actually win, which is actually can be a brutal movie at times.
Which speaks well about this past decade. We've had less and less Oscar bait kind of movies win, except with the exception of pretty much. Although I think
Crash.
I'm sorry.
Well, Crash. That was the ultimate example of what of ultimate Oscar baiting.
Well, I was going to say A Beautiful Mind, but yeah, that too.
Man. Well, Crash is just more offensive than A Beautiful Mind. I can see, yeah, Beautiful Mind. Yeah, I don't even know what else. I can't remember what it was going for in 2001.
Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah, 2001 was Fellowship of the Ring, really. And, like, you know, those 2001 was a decent year. I mean, In the Bedroom was a good movie. I mean, just, what else? God, my head is blank.
But you can tell which movies are Oscar bait. But, you know, it's been said before, you know, the behavior of the Academy. And really, that those awards really don't mean anything. I mean,
not really.
You know, you can just list example after example after example throughout the years. So
the one everyone loves to go back to is Gandhi. Everyone loves to pull that up. Gandhi over E.T. It's like, yeah, that's always the go-to answer for a reason.
Well, no, the other one is Dances with Wolves over Goodfellas.
Yeah. Although Dances with Wolves is a bigger hit, though. People seem to forget that. That was actually a huge hit when it opened. I mean,
it was. It was. But even then, it's still in terms of the movie people tend to remember.
Yeah.
That seemed going back to Scott Pilgrim. I think this is going to, for you know, real film fans, I think this is going to stick in their mind quite a bit. You know,
I mean, my feeling is, like, in terms of, and I wrote this article a while back, during our tenure elsewhere, about how, you know, because of Scott Pilgrim and a number of other comic movies were very expensive, and they were niche comic book films, that studios are going to stop depending on those kind of movies to bankroll, and they're going to go to brand names, and we're seeing it more and more. The exception of Marvel, who, as everyone knows now, is sort of, they're thinking beyond Avengers and saying, you know, let's go for lower budget movies with, you know, B, C, D list characters, and we'll take the creative risk with a lower budget now. I applaud them for that. But everything else is going to be But everything else is going to be the brand names. Hence why Warner Brothers right now has got, you know, I got Batman 3, they've got Superman, Man of Steel, and you know, they'll eventually do a Justice League movie, a Green Lantern sequel possibly, the big name characters. And then all the other like Sony's got Spider-Man, Fox is milking the X-Men, you know, they're fishing that lake dry. I mean, but that's all you're going to see. You're not going to see, like, you know, Savage Dragon the movie. You're not going to get that.
Right.
You know, it's interesting.
My milk and cheese movie.
Damn it.
I was watching a documentary today. I was talking to Jamie about this that I just imported over called Tales from the Script. I believe that's what it's called anyway. And Jamie's seen it as well. It's a documentary. It's about 100 minutes long, and it interviews basically every screenwriter you've ever heard of is in this documentary. Just talking about the trade, just talking about how things used to be, classic anecdotes, how hard it is to get a movie made. William Goldman's, of course, classic line about how nobody knows anything. There's a particular excerpt that I'm thinking about right now where they talk to Billy Ray, who, of course, we know as the writer and director of Shattered Glass. He was talking about how, you know, he doesn't respond to those type of comic book movies. The reason he got into the business in the first place is that he wanted to work in the industry that produced all those classic films of the 70s that we think of, that wonderful eclectic mix, everyone a winner, and that the movies that can't get made today. Now, I don't know why that is, but I think it seems, fact of the matter is, those movies got made because the somebody sitting behind a desk writes a check and says yes. It's simply down to individuals, and the fact is, either there are too many cooks these days that are all too worried about their jobs to take those kind of risks, or it's the lack of talent out there. It's hard to say for somebody who really doesn't work in the industry, Lou, but I definitely know what you're talking about. But the main thing about it, just to throw it back to you, Lou, is that Also, how many movies are getting made today versus the 70s, for example? Is it like quadrupled, the amount of pictures that get made? And how many of them are identikit? If you think about it like that, it is depressing.
Well, you think about the 70s, yeah. I mean, like, there was a lot more creative a risk of saying, you know, we're going to make a movie like a sorcerer or, you know,
well,
movies
the,
with...
Well, the other thing is, I think with the 70s also, it was a lot cheaper to make movies then.
Exactly. That's
well, that's
one of the big drivers. And I think that's where I'm basing this on, is because the cost of these movies is getting larger and larger. So to recoup those costs, they have to, you know, they're pushing those products into this distribution chain that's geared towards supporting only blockbuster-type movies. They're not geared towards supporting the smaller pictures anymore because of the cost of making these movies. I think and the difference going forward right now, as opposed to say where, you know, I know in previous generations, people have been saying, making the same arguments that movies are becoming more vapid and less unique and more like out of an assembly line, is the distribution of market is fragmenting a lot more with technology, you know, with the internet and so forth. If they stay with this model, I think we're starting to see this with book publishers. One book publishing line I know that does paperbacks, they've just made an announcement because Walmart can't sell enough of their paperbacks anymore, that they're going to totally digital distribution and only publishing their books on print on demand. And I think the costs of movies are driving the same thing, because you have to make these big budget pictures to return your costs
quickly.
And Roger Ebert may not like this, but I think the only way that cinema is going to survive going forward is if they change
the word. Don't say the word.
And go to digital distribution instead of film. And I know a lot of purists aren't going to like that, but I think for these smaller pictures to survive, distributions of their movies is going to have to get cheaper. And I think the move to digital distribution is one of the ways to get around that. Otherwise, all the good stuff, drama-wise, from my perspective, is going to cable TV right now, where the costs are lower, but because they have, you know, the distribution networks through TV and internet and so forth, that they can do these types of stories.
Well, also with cable, you can take your time. You don't have to. You're not on the 22 episode a season model. You can do 10 to 13 episodes max and actually focus in on how and making that the best show you can. That's why
you're not restricted in content like you are with, say, broadcast television, because standards
too,
practices and all that stuff.
I mean, talking about film real quick, about the 70s, the other thing is that a movie could stay in theaters for a while, forever. I mean, like a movie, it was normal for a movie to be number one for a month. It was normal. And it could still be a bump.
You're lucky if your movie's in the theater for a month.
Yeah. It's a staying power. You know, just
2001 would have been a bomb if this market was just like that back then, because that movie played for like years before it made its money back. So
absolutely,
like that kind of stuff's not going to happen. The patience is gone. You gotta give, like, it's gotta be all sizzle. And but how much behind that sizzle can you put? Like, that's a hard trick. And
we also have the problem of discovery. It's like the internet. People immediately find out about these movies. It's so weird now for a movie to come out that nobody was following, that nobody had any awareness of.
Yeah,
I don't know the last time we had a movie like that. I mean,
Abrams is probably the master of that right now.
And that's why everyone loves the guy. That's why it's such a breath of fresh air that it's going back to the way it used to be. And I love the fact that everything's being so top secret. I have no idea what Super 8's about. That movie could be a porno. I don't know what it's about, but I'm looking forward to it because it's just being so...
J.J. Abrams' remake of Hardcore. Wow.
J.J. Abrams' Debbie Does Dallas.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, didn't Nick Cage have a movie 8mm that was a porno? This might be the sequel.
Yeah.
Snuff film. Snuff film. It was Joel Schumacher. Enough said.
Right. I just want to say that I think there's still going to be the little movies. That those are always going to be. A great example would be like Moon.
Yeah, but I think
it's odd.
I don't remember the internet going crazy about Moon. That was just a couple of reviews, and then, you know, and then it took off. And like I said, it's one of those movies that's getting rediscovered a lot, I'd say.
It played at festivals. Like, it did it the traditional way. It played at festivals, and it got a buzz going that way.
Yes. I mean, could you imagine if, like, Star Wars had, like, come out now with the way the internet is? I mean, like, it just couldn't have. Wouldn't have made an impact. She wouldn't have.
We can't say that for sure, but it's an interesting thing to speculate.
You think it could have had an impact, say, like District 9 did?
Maybe. That's true.
Market properly.
But I guess what I mean is, like, it came out of nowhere. I mean, nobody knew what George Lucas was doing after American Graffiti. He just went off to London and made this weird Flash Gordon sci-fi adventure serial thing that everyone says is stupid. And look, and it changed it. You know, it changed the business.
Absolutely. The question I had, getting back to something Lou was talking about a little earlier, about the costs of things, I'm still waiting for an answer on this. I don't know when we're going to get to the answer, but the idea of this ridiculous amount of spending that takes place in the movie business these days, costs getting out of control, even on pictures where there's no excuse for it to. It just seems inconceivable how much it takes just to make the most basic of studio pictures these days. It's not uncommon for a period to be taking place in movies where you spend ridiculous amounts of money to make the biggest spectacle. Of course, that was very famously done in the 50s to compete with television, where they were making all of these epics. They were bigger and bigger and bigger. Eventually, though, the bubble burst on that. My question is, eventually, I'm still waiting for the answer on this, eventually, is the bubble going to burst? There's only so far you can go spending money on a picture. I know Jamie still maintains that Avatar cost $500 million. Maybe he's right. I don't know.
If you don't think it costs that close, you're nuts. With those kind of innovative effects, it's like if you look at, you know, Spider-Man 3 and Pirates 3 and all the sequels being $300 million minimum budget, it's like you look at Avatar, you go, yeah, you'd be crazy not to think it cost an arm, a leg, you know, a tumor, every other body part possible.
Souls. Lots of souls.
Lots of souls.
Even in that case, it only strengthens the argument that how can people spend that in good conscience, no matter what you've got on your hands? When do we reach the ceiling? When does it stop? And is it going to end?
Waterworld 2. I have no idea.
Oh, Jesus.
I have no idea. Good question.
Thanks.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's just the thing, though. I mean, 10 years ago, $100 million budget was like, oh, my God. And granted, you know, you look at movies like Terminator 2 and Total Recall from the beginning of the 90s, those were $100 million budgets, but they didn't say they were $100 million. Granted, people lie about budgets all the time, but once we got to those kind of huge numbers, I mean, for a while, like, wasn't Roger Rabbit and Batman the most expensive movies ever made? Those were made for like $60 to $70 million or $80.
That was also in the time when an actor would get $20 million. For a role, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's just that I've noticed year by year it just seems to go up and up and up. Like 2004, I heard Spider-Man 2 costs $200 million. I'm like, what?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, look, I love it. It's a comic book movie, but really, you're spending that much on Spider-Man 2? Then, you know, year after that, or even longer after, sorry, Superman Returns, for example, $250 or however much that costs. Year after that, Spider-Man 3, $300 million. Pirates 3, God knows how much. What the bottom line really was in Pirates 3. And then, of course, Avatar, if what you say is true, even more than that, just goes up and up and up and up. And it never stops.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's completely irresponsible.
Yeah, and I think something is going to happen with the movie industry. Like, the TV industry has been hit by the recession and the fact that people are, you know, have devices where they can get by the ads, and that's the only saving grace movies have right now, is that, you know, the ads are all before the movie, so I guess you'd want to come in late. That's fine, but, you know, you've paid your money for the product, whereas with TVs, because it's coming into your home, you obviously have to watch. You have to watch what they're selling you in order for them to make the revenues. And people are finding ways to get around that. And if they can find a way to get around, you know, seeing better produced movies through digital distribution, then I think then the traditional movie system is going to be in trouble. That might be a ways off yet, but I think eventually, the fact that they're pushing so much for these big budget pictures that have to deliver on a first weekend and be the number one box office thing, I think they're just pushing themselves towards some sort of implosion, and the technical innovation that we have today with the internet and that is going to make the difference, and it's not going to be something that they can walk away from as easily as what happened in the 70s or the 80s.
I have one question to ask you, Lou. I'm thinking back, even though we've had, like, it, you know, we're a little bit sick of this lack of originality. I, I think back on last year, for example, there were some sucky summer movies.
Oh, yeah.
You know, things that we focus on that we talk about on our show. But at the end of the year, we had a reflect, and I talked, and we talked, and we realized, damn, there were a lot of really, really great movies last year. I've seen some really great movies this year. So I don't really lament or think like the movie industry's in a really bad way, because we still get such wonderful movies every year. And
it's one of those arguments. For me, it's one of those arguments. It's like people saying every year, like, every you're going to hear all the time, like, oh, do critics really matter? We always get that stupid argument. And yeah. It's same thing as this. I mean, like, our movie's getting worse every year. Do critics really matter? We're going to keep hearing that. It's never going to stop.
Yeah. So where do you stand on that, Lou? I mean, are you an old fogey who hates the world and hates cinema, and you shouldn't be here?
No, but I agree with you. I mean, like, you can always find in each year good movies. Like that, because so many are being made, it's just, you know, law of averages that, yeah, we can easily pick out a handful of great movies every year, but I just think that we're heading it down a path, or the movies are heading down a path where there's an implosion that's going to take place. And the fallout will be different than what it would have been in previous years because of the digital distribution and things of that nature.
Hmm. Oh, a new hat.
Yes, yeah. That too.
Yeah. Well said, sir.
All relates to that new hat.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's not really... It's so different as a hat. But yeah, with that note, we're going to wrap up this week's Movie Moan. Gentlemen, good to have you as always. Thanks for being here. Couldn't do it without you.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Right back at you.
Thanks, folks.
Oh, sorry. I almost forgot.
Go ahead.
Commenters. A to the H, Lighthouse, Welsh Film Buff. Thank you very much for leaving your comments. We absolutely love them. Thank you so much for the response last week about the movie posters. Lighthouse, I personally love the actual painted image of Superman 3. I hate what it represents, having Richard Pryor on it, but that was really, really interesting. A to the H said, do we want to talk about At the Movies being cancelled? But if we do, we'll talk about it next week. We're running over. And Welsh Film Buff, I really, really hope you enjoy the Park Plaza Hotel in London next to the BFI IMAX. I've recommended that to him. Hope you have a great time.
Nice. Cool. Hey, guys, thanks for listening. You have a great week. We will see you same time, same place, at the movies. Take it easy. Bye.
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 Bye.